Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. According to Sightline Institute in Seattle, Tacoma, Washington is the major frontline community in the fight to stop fossil fuel development in the Northwest. After vehemently rejecting a proposal to build the world's largest methanol refinery at the port of Tacoma, citizens are now taking on a liquefied natural gas facility that Puget Sound Energy plans to build at the port. Today we talk with Tarika Powell with Sightline, who has been providing in-depth research and education that supports community members working to redefine Tacoma. Tarika is a researcher who anchors Sightline Institute's work on fossil fuel infrastructure development. In particular, her detailed research on the safety and climate implications of frack gas expansion projects provides critical information to activists and policymakers alike. Tarika, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to finally have you on. I've been hearing about you for years, actually, and especially since I've been spending a lot of time in Tacoma in the last 6 months, and your name keeps popping up. And the other phrase that has been popping up a lot is how a lot of people I talk to there refer to themselves as living in a frontline community. I think that's a term that mm-hmm. they've gotten from you and Eric. So I wanted to know, why does Sightline consider Tacoma to be a frontline community?
Well, that's a good question, Barbara, and I probably would start by defining what that is so that all of your listeners are aware of what that term means. A frontline community is a community that is they're sometimes called a fence line community because they're often communities that share a fence line, a border with heavy polluting facilities. We know that in terms of fossil fuel facilities and other heavy polluting industries, they're more likely to be located in communities with lower incomes, more likely to be located in closer proximity to communities of color, indigenous lands. They are more likely to be located in or near communities where there are lower overall education levels and higher needs for jobs. And so these communities we see getting hit with these same types of industries over and over, often because of zoning laws that really basically prevent them from being located near the wealthier, wider communities and incentivize them being located near lower-income communities and or communities of color. And this becomes an environmental justice issue when particular communities are repeatedly exposed to higher levels of industry pollution than other communities.
Well, I know.
And so,
continue.
Go ahead, Barbara. Yeah.
No, continue. What were you going to say?
And so when we come to Tacoma, the reason that we are dealing with an environmental justice issue in Tacoma is that in the Pacific Northwest, we have seen several waves of the fossil fuel industry attempting to site large-scale export infrastructure here in this region. The first wave was coal, and then coal proposals, which would have produced lots of coal trains going through the region. And then we had a wave of oil-by-rail proposals, and then we're dealing with the third wave, which is the fracked gas industry, what we formerly called natural gas. The majority of it now, about 70%, comes from fracking, so we refer to it as fracked gas. And so there are particular communities in the Northwest that have been targeted more than others because they have the deep water ports that these facilities need. So when you look at a city like Tacoma, and we talk about those three waves of assault from the fossil fuel industry, the city of Tacoma is one of the places that has been hit by all three, like Whatcom County. And so we're not just dealing with an overall increase of pollution for the region. We're dealing with basically some cities would be the hub and they would take the bigger hit. And Tacoma is one of those cities with a bullseye on their backs. And I do believe that the issues that Tacoma has been struggling with in terms of fighting off the fossil fuel industry wouldn't be happening in a city like Seattle with the types of proposals we've seen down there. The way that they have been so badly mishandled, I don't believe that that would happen in a city like Seattle. And so that is one reason that it's an environmental justice issue. Why is it able to happen in this city and not in another wealthier city? And additionally, there is a major issue with tribal rights with the proposals going on down there, in particular the Tacoma Liquefied Natural Gas, Tacoma LNG proposal. And so that's why we're looking at Tacoma in general as a frontline community.
Well, what's interesting to me about Tacoma, well, there's a lot of things, and we'll get into it in this hour, but when you talk about these projects affecting largely communities of color and low-income communities, in Tacoma, ironically, one of the communities that's being most affected by what goes on in the port in general, and specifically the LNG facility, is Northeast Tacoma, which is up on the bluffs mm-hmm. above the port, and has some very many million-dollar homes, great views, and horrible air quality. And then the other, and then the irony of it is that when you, I just realized this when I was there this past week, when you drive into the port of Tacoma, the first sign you see is you are on the Puyallup Reservation. So uh-huh. the Puyallup tribe has land holdings all around the closest to the port of anybody, and they're probably the most marginalized community in Tacoma. Uh-huh. So I see this interesting thing where everybody in Tacoma is basically a frontline community, whether you're a real high-income white community or whether you're tribal uh-huh. or you're African-American or you're Latino.
I completely agree with you, Barbara, and in working on this issue, Tacoma LNG, for the last several years, I have worked with people across the income spectrum, people of many different ethnicities, cultural backgrounds on this issue. You have the tribe, which did not get meaningful consultation on the project. It's being built on a site that a court actually has found two times when some protesters were on the site trying to stop construction because they did not have permits in hand to do that construction. And there's been two court cases in which the jury has ruled in favor of the protesters because the prosecution could not prove that the land they were on where the facility is being built actually belongs to the port and not to the tribe. And so you have the tribal members involved in the issue. You have white small business owners, wealthier white individuals, as you were saying, all of them in the city of Tacoma being affected. And so you are seeing the demographics that are typically a part of a frontline community where we're typically dealing with low income, we're typically dealing mainly with people of color. That is being the definition of the frontline community is being quite broadened by the struggle in Tacoma right now because, as I was saying earlier, the port there has a big target on its back because we only have so many deep water ports in the region. And when we have, for example, dozens of proposals for coal, oil, and natural gas facilities over the last decade or so, it's the same cities getting hit over and over. And so, in essence, everyone in those cities becomes a part of the frontline community. And Tacoma is a good example of that.
Well, I've been hearing, when I was up in Tacoma this past week, I was hearing an awful lot about the disparity between the ports of Seattle and the ports of Tacoma. And I had this quote that kept coming back, which is a quote from the executive director of the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency, Craig Kenworthy. And he says at one point, "Why is the health of the people of Tacoma less important than the health of the people of Seattle?" And I think that that's something a lot of people in Tacoma raise. But it seems that there are people in Tacoma, in the port and in the city government, who really don't care that much about the health of the people in that community. Do you think that's true?
Well, Barbara, it would certainly seem that way. I'm certainly not in their minds and hearts to know what they truly care about. But their actions would indicate that. I think that in terms of individuals at the port, and over the last several years, I've watched and observed quite a number of port meetings and city council meetings. It rather seems that the people on the Port Commission feel that their number one objective, the instruction that they have to carry out for their job, is to bring jobs to the city. And they essentially look at that as a at-any-cost proposition, it seems, where it doesn't matter what kind of jobs they are, it doesn't matter what negative outcomes the jobs will have, it doesn't matter if it's a facility that's going to produce millions of pounds of pollution each year in return for only a dozen jobs that may or may not go to people who actually live in the city. It seems that the perspective of the politicians there is just to notch some things for their resumes that would appear to be accomplishments. And the question is, for the people of Tacoma, well, what about our city outcomes in the long run? separate from your political career. And so it very much does seem that the people in power in the city are much more concerned about building up resumes than about the long-term health and economics of the city for the people.
Well, it does seem also that Tacoma has a very different kind of political culture than either Seattle or Portland does. While Seattle and Portland are at least noted for priding themselves in having a very sustainable, forward future, forward-looking, green, conscious view of how they want the cities to move forward, in Tacoma, it's much more of a tradition of this is how we've always done it, and so this is how we'll always do it. And so I wanted you to sort of expand on that, because that's what I pick up the more I go to Tacoma. I realize that they're really thinking in a different decade, if not a different century, than it seems that Seattle and Portland are.
I think, and, I love Tacoma, so let me put that out there first. I love the city. I love the people. I spend as much time there as I can. But I think one of the problems that is wrapping the city up, you have the people of Tacoma who have shown over the last several years that they're ready to go in a forward direction. They're ready to come into the present, if not move into the future. And they're dealing with a political structure that, as you said, is stuck in a several decades old paradigm where essentially we borrow from our future to build a little something right now so that we can get reelected. And the local government there, from my interactions with them, appear to feel that this is a Wild West scenario wherein they can do whatever they like. When it comes to trying to raise questions about what they are doing, what happens, Barbara, is that the politicians in Tacoma will play on the old rivalry between the city of Seattle and the city of Tacoma that I'm sure that you're well aware of, and say, essentially, look at these big city folks trying to come here and tell us what to do. But actually what has been happening is that the people of Tacoma have been reaching out to organizations and politicians throughout the region because they're unable to reach out to their local government and be heard. And so you're seeing a lot of really dated tactics, but it's so deeply ingrained throughout the local government in the city that it's very difficult to get around. And, one of the ways is in trying to vote these individuals out. The fossil fuel fights of the last couple of years, including the methanol debacle that they had down there, and this LNG fight, has been shaking up the political scene there a little bit. But I think it's going to take a little while, a couple of elections, for us to really start seeing the change. But I think that if the politicians in office there right now do not feel at least a little bit afraid for their jobs, then they're not really paying attention.
Well, I want to add
is changing.
I want to add that I've been falling in love with Tacoma every time I go up there, because I think it's what some of my friends would call a drive-through city for those of us who live in Portland to Seattle. But when you actually stop there, you realize it's the most beautiful place on the Puget Sound. And that also I've been getting to know these people that are really, they're very heartening seeing the fight that they've taken on. So it's a very inspiring place to be. And that's why we're doing the show today. And I won't let you know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Trika Powell, who is with Sightline Institute, and she's a researcher with Sightline Institute, and we're talking about what puts Tacoma, Washington on the front lines of the fossil fuel fights in the Northwest. Well, I wanted to talk specifically now about this LNG facility. I guess it's a combination of being a refinery, storage terminal, and also possibly a terminal for export. What makes this unique, and why is it becoming such a flashpoint in Tacoma?
That's a good question, Barbara, and I will try to explain it with the short version. As you know, I've been working on this for quite some time, and I have a lot of knowledge I could download. But to your question about what is making this a flashpoint, a couple of years ago, there was a proposal for a methanol facility in Tacoma. It would have been the largest methanol facility in the world. And methanol is a petrochemical, meaning that it can be derived from fossil fuels. And it basically is put through a process that converts it into a chemical that is a precursor in making plastics. And it consumes a tremendous amount of water. It produces a tremendous amount of pollution. And when it was basically just like this LNG facility, pushed through under the radar. The people did not know about it. People did not receive notice. They are supposed to receive notice of projects such as this so that they can comment on them, so that they can find out about the potential safety issues to them and their families, so they can find out about the pollution issues. Nobody was made aware. And when people found out that this facility was underway and that it had been pushed through under the radar, there was basically an uprising in the city. Not a violent one, obviously, but a passionate one where people showed up in the thousands to city council meetings, which is something that rarely happens. People showed up in the hundreds to information sessions that Sightline put on and that other organizations put on. I saw people there with their entire families, Barbara, taking notes on at a scientist lecture about the chemical properties of methanol. People were very engaged. The people of Tacoma are very intelligent, and they really want to know what is going on. They are tired of this scenario where the government just pushes through whatever they want to push through, again, for the sake and the benefit of a small number of people and to the detriment of the city at large. And so when you had that methanol thing happen a couple of years ago, it really made people angry and upset that their local government was not representing them. And they later found out that at the same time that the methanol facility was pushed through under the radar, this liquefied natural gas facility was as well. And liquefied natural gas is what it sounds like. It's natural gas in liquid form. You basically cool it to a cryogenic temperature, negative 260 degrees. And then the gas turns into a liquid, and it shrinks in volume by 1/600. And so you can store a lot more of the gas in a storage tank if it's in liquid form than if it's in gaseous form. And so that's one of the reasons that we convert natural gas to a liquid to store a lot of it, and it's often used during those peak days of winter when it's very cold and everybody in the city has on some heating of some sort. Those are peak winter days, and so a lot of times the facility that stores LNG is called a peak shaver. And this LNG facility that's being built in Tacoma was sold to the community as a peak shaver. That is a small facility that's going to be storing some gas for local people's needs in the winter. But, Barbara, we found out that is not at all what the facility is. That is only 7% of the gas that the LNG they're going to be producing at the facility is going to go to that purpose for local people. The other 93% is absolutely not. And so when people found out that this was actually a private enterprise and it was going to be producing this pollution, dredging up contaminated sediments at the port, because we have several sites down there that were part of a Superfund site, potentially poisoning the waters and not getting an adequate review for the type of facility that it actually is, you know, they felt like, well, we just went through this. How many times are our elected officials going to do the same thing? How many times do we have to say no? How many times do we have to say this is not the direction that the city of Tacoma wants to go in before someone will listen to us? And so basically, you know, the reason that it's become a flashpoint is because people are sick and tired. They thought that when they defeated the methanol terminal that they had sent a clear message, and then they turn around and learn that basically, even though thousands of people showed up and there was this massive, like I said, basically an uprising, that still it seems no one listened to them. And so they're just going, they seem that they want to keep fighting, and they're going to keep fighting until they deliver the message, until they let their elected officials know that we want to have a voice in these projects. We are supposed to have a voice in these projects. We are supposed to be able to submit public comment. That is the only opportunity that the public gets to participate in the process whatsoever, and they keep being closed out of it because the notice that is sent out to people is within 400 feet of the site, and if you've been down there to the port, you know that that's still within the port, and nobody's living within 400 feet, so nobody's finding out about these projects until they're well underway. No one can do anything about it, and then they find that they are in the blast zone of an explosion, or that this is going to increase the pollution of the city by hundreds of thousands of pounds to millions of pounds of pollution every year. And I think, Barbara, that it's becoming a flashpoint because the people in Tacoma are just tired of being pushed over.
Now, it seemed that there was a quicker reaction to the methanol refinery a couple years ago, and you were describing thousands of people who were coming to these hearings. My understanding from talking to people who are trying to fight the LNG facility is that it's a much harder struggle. And why is that? Or it's a much harder struggle to get people involved.
Well, I think one of the reasons, Barbara, is that people have a misconception about natural gas. It's right there in the name. It says natural. People think that it's a clean fuel. People think that it's a better alternative. The average person, if you tell them that you are opposing a natural gas project, well, their question would be, why? Isn't it better than coal? Isn't it better than diesel and all of these other things? And the truth is that this is another misconception that we have been sold over time. What most people believe right now about natural gas being clean is similar to what people used to believe once upon a time, that smoking cigarettes was not bad for your health. There's a lot of parallels, and there's a lot of the messaging that is used by the fossil fuel industry was perfected by the tobacco industry at one point, and you have the same messaging people and lobbyists working throughout both industries. And so I think that one of the reasons that it's been harder with the LNG facility is because of the public's misperception about natural gas. Well, natural gas, go ahead.
I was going to say, what are some of the, because this is something, a conversation I had with a lot of people, and we've talked a lot about this on the show. What is it about natural gas now that is actually so much more dangerous than it was 20 years ago, particularly in terms of greenhouse gas emissions?
Okay, that's a good question. About 20 years ago, the way that we extracted natural gas is essentially you put a pipeline, put some pipeline infrastructure into the ground. The gas flows through the pipeline infrastructure. It wasn't very difficult to extract. But as we are using up more and more of those conventional resources, we are turning more and more to the extremely environmentally detrimental practice called fracking, which produces millions of gallons of toxic wastewater and other pollutants at a site. And today, so 20 years ago, not very much of our gas came from fracking. Today, about 70% of the natural gas produced in the United States comes from fracking. So the more we use natural gas, the more we increase the amount of fracking that is happening throughout the country, and that fracking is poisoning people, it's poisoning animals, it's causing birth defects, it is rendering land unusable. The toxic wastewater from the fracking is migrating to communities all over the place, and again, these are frontline communities who don't have very much power to fight back against this industry. And so the more we consume natural gas now, the more we increase fracking. A lot of people associate fracking with oil, but the fact is that we frack more natural gas than oil. Oil, we frack about 50% of what we produce here. With natural gas, it's 70% and increasing. And that's why we refer to it as fracked gas, because there's nothing natural about it. It's not the natural gas that we knew 20 years ago. It has a very different environmental profile from the beginning to the end. And at the beginning, you have fracking, which is bad enough. But as we transmit it to sites like Tacoma LNG through pipelines, because it's a gas and we do not have very good laws in terms of keeping track of leaks that are happening, it's leaking all over the place in quantities that actually are reducing the benefits that we used to be able to get, believe we were getting, from burning natural gas. The gas itself is a greenhouse gas. When you burn coal, you burn oil, you produce a greenhouse gas. When you burn natural gas, you produce greenhouse gases as well. But in its unburned form, it is also a greenhouse gas, and it's actually much more potent than carbon dioxide by between 36 times to 84 times worse at trapping heat in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. And so we're spending all of this time and energy and money trying to reduce carbon dioxide from fossil fuels like coal and oil, and then we turn to a fossil fuel, fracked gas, that actually is 36 to 84 times worse from a greenhouse gas perspective when it leaks than the thing we're trying to reduce. It's worse than carbon dioxide itself. And so it is a shaky proposition. It doesn't make sense at all to switch from one fuel to relying on a fuel that when it leaks can be up to 87 times worse than the thing we were getting away from. And so these are the things that we have found out about natural gas in recent decades that the public so far does not know as a general matter. More people are learning about it. Just last week there was a big article in the New York Times about these natural gas leaks. Last week there was some coverage on NPR. And so we are seeing more major publications tackle the issue, but what we have yet to see is local or federal governments tackle the issue to try to get these leaks under control.
Now, these leaks, to clarify, are not new. This is not something that just comes with fracking. It turns out these leaks go back as long as we've been piping natural gas around the country.
Correct, but we did not know. And one of the reasons is that when we had the energy crisis under President Carter, we were trying to see what is a fuel that we could produce here ourselves to make us less reliant on foreign powers for our energy needs, and natural gas seemed like the solution to that. And so there was a carve-out for natural gas in a lot of the rules and regulations that govern the fossil fuel industry for the purpose of that perceived security that it would provide for us to produce more of our own natural gas. And that has persisted to where the rules and regulations around natural gas leaks are much weaker than they are around leaks of oil and other fossil fuels you'll see.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG, LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking with Tarika Powell, who's a researcher with Sightline Institute in Seattle, about what puts Tacoma, Washington on the front lines of the fossil fuel fights in the Northwest. And we're also going to talk a little bit right now about where all this frack gas is coming from. So where is this frack gas coming from that they're trying to flood the Northwest with and create all these facilities, whether it's the methanol refinery that no longer is going to happen in Tacoma, but could possibly happen in Kalama and Kalatskanai, Oregon, as well as the LNG that would be flowing through Jordan Cove down Coos Bay and Tacoma LNG?
That's a good question. And people always ask when I talk about this issue, well, where does my gas come from? Because they want to know if they're using fracked gas, if they're using some of that 70% that we're talking about that's extracted in the United States. And the short answer is yes. We're all consuming fracked gas. In this region in particular, we get our gas from the Rocky Mountain states, from hubs there that are very reliant on fracking to the extent where if you get your gas directly from that region, you may have a higher percentage of fracked gas in it than 70%. It may be much higher if the wells in that region are all relying on fracking. So we get part of our gas from the Rocky Mountain region. The utility companies here purchase from there. And they also purchase a part of the gas from Canada. A lot of gas comes from basins in BC and Alberta. And so in Washington and Oregon, we're getting both Canadian gas and U.S. gas. The U.S. gas is 70% of it is fracked. In Canada, about 50% of the gas they produce is fracked, and it's expected to go up to 80% in the next 10 years. And so, yes, in our region, we are getting gas from the Rocky Mountain states, from BC and Alberta, and the vast majority of it is fracked, and it is that percentage is continuing to go up.
Now, in BC, where is that? Where are the fracking fields?
In the northeast corner, the Montney Basin, which is basically part of it is in BC, a part of it is in Alberta.
And I understand that
the Montney Basin, I'm sorry.
Well, I understand that a lot of that is First Nation land, if not all of it.
That's part of one of what one of the issues is. When we're dealing with the gas that comes down from that basin and the pipelines that have to be built when we build big projects like Jordan Cove or like a methanol facility that have to build more pipeline infrastructure going up into that basin, we're dealing with impacting a number of First Nations in BC, and we're also dealing with impacting a number of tribes in the United States. From where the tribes are a great example of a frontline community because they're impacted throughout the supply chain. They are impacted at the site where the gas is extracted. There are going to be tribes or First Nations whose lands and treaty rights are going to be imposed upon when the pipelines that are carrying the gas from that extraction site are always going through multiple First Nations or tribal lands. And then the facilities are usually sited near or on the lands of yet a different set of peoples. And then the tankers going back and forth to the facilities are going through the fishing areas of some of those same people and sometimes a different set of people. And so every single point along the supply chain of these large projects that the industry is trying to build here is impacting several First Nations and sometimes hundreds or thousands. When we look at some of the projects up in BC, some of the LNG projects there, they've got 16 proposals. Some of the pipelines for their proposals are 600 to 900 miles of pipeline and through basically a lot of lands where there are not very many people who live there besides the First Nations. And so they are sometimes being the only people impacted. And so upholding the rights, treaty rights of First Nations and tribes is a big part of this work, and it's a big part of what is making Tacoma LNG a flashpoint, as you said. Lots of people are coming here to try to help the Puyallup tribe assert their rights to be consulted on projects that are going to have negative environmental impacts to their lands or negative impacts to any of their other treaty rights. And they were not meaningfully consulted here. And they are asking for basically the city and the company Puget Sound Energy and Totem Ocean Trailer Express Tote to uphold those legal obligations that they have to meaningfully consult with them on these projects, to not illegally construct these projects despite their objections. And the Affiliated Tribes of the Northwest is fully behind Tacoma LNG and their opposition to this project, as well as a number of tribes throughout the country.
So what kind of effect has the tribal resistance to the LNG project in Tacoma? What kind of success have they had? It seems that, is it true that nobody's really listening to them who are in the corridors of power?
Well, it depends on the issue. I would say, overall, yes, it has been very dispiriting to see that people in the corridors of power are not respecting the rights of the Puyallup tribe. They are not listening to very valid legal claims that the city and the company are acting like this is the Wild West and the state of Washington has no laws governing the building of these types of facilities. We see every day construction continue on this facility. It's been at least half a year, and no one has done anything about it. They do not have permits to construct from the Clean Air Agency, and that process, the Clean Air Agency's process, won't even be finished until sometime later in 2019. They're still going about constructing anyway, and the question is, what type of precedent are we setting here? We have a governor who likes to be seen as a green governor. We like to be seen as a state that's very progressive on these environmental issues. We like to think of ourselves as a state that respects treaty rights. But here in this one project, you have evidence that suggest that none of that is true. And so the tribe has had some small successes, but for the most part, Barbara, it does seem that they're being ignored.
Well, I was talking to a couple people from the port last week, and I asked them about this issue about building without permits, and they basically said, we don't need the permits to build.
I don't know what to say to that, Barbara.
I mean, that's not exactly, that's kind of paraphrasing it, but I basically sound like it's a non-issue is what they were saying to me. And I guess they assume that they're going to get the permits. And I think, the analogy would be like, you know, when you're building your house and you start building, you know, doing plumbing, even though you don't have your electrical permit, because you know you're going to get your electrical permit.
And, you know, the reason that that analogy is off is because your house does not produce hundreds of thousands of tons of pollutants every year. Installing the plumbing in your house is not creating a blast zone that's several miles wide that could incinerate anyone who lives in that area. When you're constructing, you don't need a fire station located within 10 minutes of your house specifically because it is such a fire hazard. And so the analogies that those individuals are using are way off base.
Well, the other thing that I've been following is the effort, the kind of confusion. In fact, I was listening to your testimony last night and about the environmental impact station. They have a final environmental impact statement, but it's was basically released without a whole lot of other information that really needed to be added. So people in Tacoma have been requesting a supplemental environmental impact statement. And let's talk a bit about the status of that.
Okay. And I think that similar to what you were just saying, when it comes to the environmental and safety review for the project, a lot of the analysis that should have gone on before this project was allowed to move forward, they basically put it off as, well, let's just go ahead and approve it and we'll get to all of that. And when you're dealing with liquefied natural gas, it's actually a very volatile fuel. When it's in that liquid state that I talked about, when it's in a storage tank, when it's at negative 260 degrees, it actually cannot catch fire, which seems, you know, at first doesn't make sense to people because we think of natural gas as being flammable. But actually, when you condense it like that, the concentration of methane is so high that it can't catch fire. It has to mix with oxygen, about 10 to 15% mixture. And at that point, it will become flammable. So if there's any leak from any of the containment systems there, or if there's some sort of an accident, at that point, the gas will start mixing with the air. And the further it drifts off from the facility, actually, the more flammable it is because it's mixing with a higher concentration of oxygen. And so they keep saying it's safe because LNG doesn't catch fire. But that is only if the LNG is just going to be kept in the tank forever. We're going to put it in the tank. We're never going to do anything with it. But the fact is that this is going to be a transportation hub where they're going to be providing the LNG as fuel to ships and tanker trucks. So every day they're going to be doing transfers from the tank to through ambient temperatures to another location. And that is when the risk comes in. And that's going to be happening countless times throughout the day at this facility. And so when you look at the safety studies that were conducted on the facility, they reviewed the safety of the facility like it was a peak shaver, like I said earlier, like it's just a storage site that's storing gas for customers for the winter. Again, 93% of it is not going to be used for that purpose. 93% is going to be used for transportation fuel. And so this is a hybrid bunkering facility. Bunkering means providing a fuel to a ship. And traditionally that was heavy fuel oil that was called bunker fuel. That's why it's called bunkering. But you can also do now bunkering with LNG fuel. And one of the issues is that we did not have any, when this facility's EIS was going through, we only had one bunkering, LNG bunkering facility in the United States. It was much simpler, in scope and size than the one they're building in Tacoma. And we did not yet have adequate laws and regulations around safety for bunkering facilities. We had laws for export facilities. We had laws for safety laws for storage facilities. But we did not have any bunkering facilities here, so the Coast Guard had not come up with those regulations.
Well, I also understood when I was taken down, I got a little tour of the port last month, and there's a pipeline that's going to be coming from the LNG tank, and it basically goes across the little peninsula there, doesn't it, to where it's actually going to load on trucks, and then it's going to wind up going to the get loaded onto the boats. And my question to the people who were showing it to me was, is that pipeline refrigerated that they have to, it has to go through? Because as soon as you de-refrigerate LNG, then it's no longer LNG, then it's just NG and very explosive.
And another thing is that in the safety, because the safety review was inadequate, because we did not have, we only have one bunkering facility here in the United States, the reviewers, the city could have looked for others with expertise on this issue. There are some established bunkering facilities in Europe, around Norway, and there are some companies in Europe that specialize in this. In fact, when the Washington Department of Transportation was considering converting some of the ferry routes to LNG fueling a couple of years ago, they hired some of those experts out of Europe to come and help them with that proposal. The city of Tacoma basically hired a random who had only done one environmental impact analysis on an LNG facility in the past, and it was one of those storage facilities. It was nothing like the one that they're building there now. And when you look at the review of this project for safety and environmental hazards, you see that the company that produced that had absolutely no idea what they were doing. And as a result, every permit that is based on that is based on some faulty information that has not been adequately analyzed. And not only that, that the foundations of it are shaky. As time goes on, more and more things occur that raise concerns about this facility. So the people involved, we already knew that PSC had a poor safety record. In fact, they blew up the commercial center of the city of the neighborhood of Greenwood here in Seattle just a few years ago. And but then we had a sinking of one of the tote ships, and an analysis of that recently came out that found that Tote, which is the company that's going to be using most of the LNG fuel down there at the port, they're going to be doing most of the transfers of this flammable fuel. Their company was also found to have poor safety practices. And then we had a leakage at an LNG site down in Louisiana, and we look at who was maintaining, who was in charge of the company in charge of maintaining those facilities, those tanks. Well, it's the same company that's building the tanks for the Tacoma site. So now we have three players that we have very, very strong concerns about their safety practices and their commitment to safety. And on top of that, we have the issue with the fire station. For this facility to be built, there needed to be a fire station within 10 to 12 minutes of the site. There were none when the proposal was going through, because the closest fire station had actually been closed some years before during some financial constraints. So they were going to reopen this fire station at the Tide Flats in order for that facility to be approved and to be considered safe. They had to reopen that fire station to be close enough to get there, given the traffic problems down there at the Tide Flats. Where now we're having an issue where that fire station is not going to be able to be rehabilitated, where they're probably going to have to build a fire station on another site. Barbara, we don't know if that's going to be within the safety range that was identified in the studies as being necessary. the city just committed and the port just committed and said, yeah, we're going to do that. We'll do that in the future. So we'll go ahead and approve it based on these safety studies because we will take care of what it says in the future. And now we're in the future and we see that we actually cannot put that fire station there. And so we need to go back and look at these safety studies again and say, okay, well, now how far away is the fire station going to be? And based on that distance, is this facility still something that can be considered safe?
I'm just going to interject for a second that let people know that you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking with Tarika Powell, a researcher with the Sightline Institute in Seattle, about a lot of challenging issues facing the city of Tacoma as the port and Puget Sound Energy are actually in the process of building a very, very large LNG storage tank that's part of a very complex facility that would... a lot of people feel would really endanger Tacoma. There's so many more things I want to talk to you about. We only have about 10 minutes left. But I guess wanted to get a little bit more about with the EIS and the effort to try to get a supplemental EIS going, that it seems like there's a fuzzy area about whether that there's a whole issue about not being able to move forward with the application for a supplemental environmental impact statement. And what's that about?
So that's a good question. Whenever you have a project like this that has to get built, that wants to be built, it has to go through an environmental review, and they produce a document called an environmental impact statement. It tells us what kind of impact this is going to have on water, land, air, marine animals. It also takes a look at some of the safety issues. How is this going to affect traffic in the region? All of that is in an environmental impact statement. And every permit that a project like this has to get, the permit is issued based on the information that's in that environmental impact statement. Well, when you have an environmental impact statement like the one that was produced for Tacoma LNG, that is completely inadequate, that doesn't actually tell you what's going on at the facility, that is missing quite a lot of information that the permits need to be based on. And then the project changes, as the project has changed a bit in the last couple of years. And I'm not going to go into that because we have a limited amount of time, but the law says that when there is a substantial change to the project, you have to do a supplemental review to make sure that the findings that you had the first time, that is still going to be safe, and that is still going to have environmental harms being addressed. And so once there were substantial changes to the project, we went to the city, Sightline, other organizations like Sierra Club, 350, and the citizens of Tacoma all submitted letters to the city saying there's been a substantial change to the project. Let's take this opportunity to take a look at what are going to be the safety impacts of that. And also, we can take this opportunity to take a look at some of the things that you all completely missed the first time you did the environmental impact statement. And the lack of response, so we submitted requests to the city. And under administrative law, when you are, you know, this all involves paperwork. When you're dealing with EISs, you don't directly go to court when you want to appeal. You have to appeal to whoever produced the document in the first place. So we had to appeal to the city. And the city sort of was like the people at the port you talked to. They basically gave a shrug. And I submitted a challenge to them on their findings on the a couple of years ago. They said they were not going to do a supplemental environmental impact statement, that the changes were not substantial enough, that they were not required to do it. And I looked at the reasons that they gave. I analyzed them. I wrote a very detailed response to say, here's why you are incorrect. And they should be required by law to respond to my challenge because it was submitted within a certain time frame. It was addressed as an appeal, and we're going on 2 years later. They still have not responded to me. I have sent them countless emails that I documented when I testified in court, repeatedly asking them, not just why are you denying this, but what law are you following that tells you that you don't even have to respond to my request for you to conduct a supplemental environmental impact analysis? Please tell me which law you believe you're following. At no point have they felt the need to respond to me. Found out recently that for a lot of that time period, they didn't have a lawyer who would address these issues. And so I guess they felt that, well, we don't have a lawyer who knows how to respond to this, so we're just not going to. So people who have submitted a request for a supplemental EIS in recent months have been getting responses from that lawyer. But the rest of us who have submitted them over the last couple of years, our appeals seem to have fallen into a black hole.
Well, in the last few moments, I want to get back to talking about the community in Tacoma that's fighting, or basically, rather than just fighting this project, I think are really trying to, their organization is called Redefine Tacoma. They really want to redefine Tacoma in a way that looks forward. And one thought that I have, I traveled up there Thursday after just learning that the ICE headquarters in Portland was totally surrounded and had been shut down. And I came up to Tacoma, and people were very excited to hear, you know, that this was going on in Portland. And that evening, I went to in Tacoma, there's the ICE detention center on the port property, actually. And there was a small demonstration, and it was very noisy. It was very small, but it was very heartfelt. And I looked at this, and I thought the difference between being in Tacoma, where getting 30, 35 people at this rally at 9 o'clock at night was a big step and compared to Portland, where the ICE facility was shut down indefinitely. But I've heard that the demonstrations around the detention center in Tacoma are increasing. There's a bigger presence. They're getting louder. And even, I think, some state senator tried to get, or some politician tried to get inside, and they didn't let him get inside. So I wonder if you see that there is like a shift where people are starting to really start to come into their power more than they might have felt. Because also when I talk to people in Tacoma about just general things, I feel there's a lot more dispiritedness than there would be either in Seattle or Portland.
And when you look at some of the issues that we've talked about over the past hour, Barbara, you can see why people would start to get fed up. And with that detention center, we've been seeing a lot in the news about our current laws that we have regarding undocumented people being separated, family, parents and children being separated. Another reason that this LNG facility being built in Tacoma is an environmental justice issue is because that detention center down there at the port is within the hazard radius of a fire or explosion at the LNG facility. And the instructions that facility has to follow is to shelter in place. Barbara, that means if there is an explosion, that the people in that detention facility are going to die. And I do not believe that being undocumented is the punishment for being undocumented. It should be death by any stretch of the imagination. And it really boggles the mind how we can look at this group of people and say, well, we will make no attempts to evacuate them in the event of an explosion at this large explosive facility that we're siting directly near this detention center. And so that's one of the issues around the detention center that has gotten people's blood boiling in the city of Tacoma, that this is something, this is not something that is acceptable to do to people.
So what do you see is the next step forward in helping Tacoma to move into the future and to protect itself from a massive incinerating explosion from an LNG tank?
Well, there's been a lot of things that have been difficult when you're working directly with the city or the port of Tacoma. Anything of Tacoma in the name of it, running into a lot of roadblocks. But the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency is doing a supplemental review because, again, they have the permit that this facility needs to construct, and the facility is constructing without a permit from them. Well, one of the reasons they haven't issued their permit is because, like me, they looked at this environmental impact statement and said, this is inadequate. This does not have the information that we need to issue a permit. And they are requiring a supplemental environmental impact statement. Now, that one is only going to look at the air quality issues. The one that we were requesting from the city of Tacoma would have looked at safety and all sorts of other issues. But one of the things that people can do to support the people of Tacoma, to support the Puyallup tribe, is that when the comment period opens up for that supplemental environmental impact statement, and the Clean Air Agency will post those dates on their website, to please submit comments on that supplemental environmental impact statement indicating all of the issues that were not analyzed for this facility, so that when the Clean Air Agency does their environmental review, we can actually get some sort of thoroughness to the analysis for the first time.
Well, Tarika, it's really great talking with you. I hope we talk again soon, and we will send us the information about the comment period, and I'll be posting that on the website.
Yes, I will. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure, thanks a lot. We've been talking today with Tarika Powell, researcher with Sightline, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus, where we also have links to Sightline's work on dealing with fossil fuel infrastructure in the Northwest. Next week, I'll be talking with Ralph Bloemers with Crag Law Center, Brenna Bell with BARC, and hopefully Wildlands firefighter Timothy Inglesby about this year's wildfire season and what we can expect. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Tom Waits. Thanks for listening. Shipwrecks. Tonight I steal your paychecks.